Okay, we're in Donald Percy's office again.
I suspect the typical person listening to Earl.
Project interview, and I'm Martin Dowling doing the interviewing. In our last session, we talked pretty much exclusively about merger. I wanted to kind of bounce around a little more.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And if we could start at the beginning, maybe, and could you describe how you came to be in Madison?
Sure. I had an undergraduate degree in political science and went to work in Washington, D.C. on a management intern program there, and ended up working in the office of the Secretary of Defense, which was a cabinet-level office. And after that, I went into the service for 2 years as a regular enlisted man, and then returned and was hired in what was called the Advanced Research Projects Agency. This is important because that's how I got into the research end of business. And I was the administrator of that agency, administrative officer, and that was the agency that had all the space stuff before NASA. So I was right there at that time. A part of that operation involved a research institute, a nonprofit research institute that provided technical support to this Advanced Research Projects Agency called ARPA. They also had a division at Princeton University. And to make a long story short, I was invited to take a responsibility, similar responsibility as an administrative officer with their division at Princeton University, which is doing communication research. The head of that institute that I worked for was Barclay Rosser, which becomes important as you go on as to how I got to Wisconsin. And Barclay was on leave from, he'd come from Cornell and was at Wisconsin, and had accepted the position of head of the Mathematics Research Center on the campus, and invited me to come there. And I interviewed, and I had made up my mind I wanted to get into academic administration by that time, and my entree was what I knew best, research administration. So I came to the Math Research Center not knowing very much about it, except that Barclay Rosser was there, that I had worked with him. And I had worked with mathematicians extensively at Princeton, and some of the same people ended up here. And it was similar. They invited visiting professors and stuff. They did primarily pure research with some applied research. At some time, it was called at one time the Army Math Research Center, but the university, of course, didn't want to couch that way.
Right.
This was while it was still all right to be associated with the Defense Department or something, still considered patriotic, and indeed, many of the people that work at this center or at other institutes around the country that had defense-related business, directly or indirectly, did so mainly as their way of rendering service to their country. They might have been conscientious objectors, or for one or another reason were never enrolled in the armed forces. So I discovered that, and it was a way that they felt they were paying a share of their citizenship responsibilities. That was true of people like Barclay Rosser, Creighton Buck, who was here, and others. So I came to the university and worked about a year or so at the Mathematics Research Center, which was a component of the College of Letters and Science. And as a component of that college, along with 42 other departments and maybe 9 other research centers, I had to operate under the dean of the College of Letters and Science, and I liked academic administration, and I made a few suggestions, and eventually was invited to become an assistant dean, or the assistant dean of that college. Now, there were other assistant deans on the student affairs side. I was more on the academic administration side, and so there was a dean, a couple associate deans, one full-time, Bob DeRemus, others part-time, representing the different disciplines. And then I was the assistant dean, and early on I was dealing with research, but eventually I got into instruction and teaching assistants, and the whole question of how we recognize people with titles and various things throughout the campuses and or throughout the college. And that sort of was my inroad to academic administration. My tenure in Math Research Center, MRC, was rather brief, you know, by any standards. And when Ed Young was dean of the College of Letters and Science, he invited me over to fill that role, and I did that. I was there about a year and a half, and then he went to be president of Maine, and I sort of, the Peter Principle operated. Anybody over history that will remember what the Peter Principle is would be good, but in essence, it's kind of a humble way of saying you got promoted, you know, and sometimes in spite of yourself. So I went out and did other things.
Well, you joined the MR, or started at the MRC, and it had already, it wasn't at a growing stage at that point, it sort of...
It had arrived, it, you know, it was sort of there. I think my recollection is that there was a competition throughout the United States. My time may be wrong, but, you know, perhaps a decade earlier, but earlier, you know, 60s, 50s. Maybe, I think it was late 50s, 56, 57. And the Defense Department was sponsoring pure research and applied research, a lot of it hoping that it would have applications of things they were doing. And so it was as if each branch of the services wanted to at least have a token of what I would call National Science Foundation kind of research, right, where they could attract intellectuals, you know, scientists and others to work, but in a university setting. No one wanted to come to an Army base to work. You know, those of us who were enlisted men in the Army could understand that, but it was kind of contrary to where they did their most productive work. So they would sponsor grants to individual faculty, which you're familiar with, or they would form institutes. It's great competition for this one, and the UW apparently won that competition, and I think it was Rudolf Langer was the person in the math department that sort of led it. I only knew him briefly, and he passed away, or knew his family briefly. I don't know too much about that history. Rosser was the pick to succeed him.
Yeah.
And Barclay, having worked with me, felt that he'd like to continue that relationship. He was the head of the institute at Princeton, and he came to this, and so I did. And just a case of kind of refining its procedures and doing things administrative officers do, and I saw it as a, and he and I fully understood this, not something I was going to do for more than a year or two, because I wanted to get into academic administration. So,
you were out of the... You were out of there really before.
Oh, yes. Before the big to-do came, you know, where the Vietnam War focused anybody who was doing defense-related research. And because this was called in the Army literature, the U.S. Army Math Research Center, which is incidentally the way they sold it in Congress so they could get the money, it was downplayed a lot here. It was always called the MRC, you know. And in fact, I do remember after leaving there, being part of an effort to simply tell the Army, why don't you just give the money to the National Science Foundation and let them fund it? I said, if this becomes a stumbling block to recruiting effective scientists, I mean, your purposes aren't going to be served. But much was made of the role of the fact that perhaps two or three of the mathematicians would be invited to come to an Army facility to comment on a problem or work on it. Not all of them did. I would say the majority of them certainly did not do that. They were not consultants, but they worked if a field like stochastic ascent was of interest to the mathematic community generally and was also of interest to the Army, they did it. So when all the hoopla over the Math Research Center, eventually culminating in its bombing, where the bomb was under my old office, as I recall, one floor down, was somewhat over-dramatized, but served the purposes of those who wanted to call attention to what many of us felt was the travesty of the Vietnam War. It was very hard not to be sympathetic, but it was also hard at that time to have anyone understand that, look, we've got a good deal. The Army's putting up this money. We're getting these mathematicians. They teach courses at the university for no charge, you know, and there's no way our students or our younger faculty would ever be exposed to giants in the mathematic community had we not gotten this. There was always that. And at the time, there was no explaining that, you know, when the issue became to the fore about it being associated with the Army. And more recently, as you know, that funding has been withdrawn.
Yeah, they just banned.
So it's over. So now the question is, how do you sustain this enterprise, you know? And that's a real difficult task for Dr. Noel, who's the current head of it. So the issue is now gone, you know, but there's so much associated.
Did the center weather that storm all right, do you think?
Oh, I think so. It was interesting because it was a research institute, and it was located in a wing off the physics building, which the Wharf spent the money for. The Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, once the university got this back in the 50s, they built that for them. And as a research institute, they didn't want to be a thoroughfare, so I remember one time they locked the doors. Langer, when he had the doors locked and put no thoroughfare. And that irritated everybody. Mm-hmm. But you know, ideally you'd been up an observatory hill where nobody would have ever bothered you, you know, or you'd be out somewhere. So there were little issues like that that would offend. But this center provided financial support for the computing center development later on, for the math physics library. They got resources from there. People, you know, it was real boom mm-hmm. to mathematics at this university. Yeah. And then it was a way to bring, we had a lot of foreign mathematicians who would come there, you know, some of the best minds. And a lot of people would come there from universities. It was the way we got some real top flight talent into the University of Wisconsin. They would come there for an appointment. They would teach. We would try to beguile them into joining the mm-hmm. faculty of the UW. So I think it served a fine purpose. And that was my first exposure to campus-based research of this type. Princeton was my other exposure, but my first approach in a Midwestern land grant in a public institution to a private mm-hmm. institution. Different things happen. Some of your questions, I just don't know the history about them. The only thing I do know is that there was an effort at one time, after I had left, to move the funding relationship through another entity, you know, and to do it openly, just simply say it's inappropriate for the Army to fund this directly. The Army, though, could fund pure research by giving a grant of money to NSF to award. And, so you ask about the relationship to university departments. There were a number of joint appointments between those departments. It was a way you could take one position in mathematics department of the university, mm-hmm. make it two half-time positions, put the other halves of those over in the Math Research Center and have two mathematicians rather than one. Same thing happened in statistics and computer science. Wow. I don't think it happened in physics more than once, but it was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And you ask about its relationship to other federally funded. It preceded the Poverty Institute. SSRI, Social Service or Sciences Research Institute, had been rising. But this is big ticket item, $1 million project, you know, it was the big thing. I think it was the largest institute of its kind in the College of Letters and Science for which it was responsible.
Mm-hmm. Well, we might as well move on then to your academic administration work. You were appointed by Mr. Young.
Yeah, Ed Young was the dean of the College of Letters and Science and invited me to be the assistant dean of the college. I worked closely with Bob DeRemus, who was the associate dean. If you wanted to think of the true administration, as you would, I think it would run along those mm-hmm. lines. There was also an associate dean for student affairs who had lots of assistant deans that did, and I had little or nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. And there was another associate dean responsible for the honors program. But we were really primarily responsible for all the research that was going on in that college, and there was lots of it. There was a young chemistry professor named Irv Shane who I worked with a lot at the outset. He was a really impressive guy. He was a good manager of his research project. But we had hundreds of faculty in the college. You got 42 departments with research grants. And so I got involved in research administration on a college-wide basis, and eventually that's how I got attached part-time up in the chancellor's office to kind of write a guideline for extramural support for the whole campus. How could we manage in a rational way the research? What policies should we have? How could we keep from getting burnt by making big investments and then having them drop on in our lap afterwards? So I sort of got a start in that, and then I branched out. It was a time when we were wrestling with what to do about teaching assistants and research assistants and project assistants. And so I got kind of learned about what those things were, and I had a concept of a teaching associate who was in between the teaching assistant and the instructor. And the whole role of the instructor was ambiguous within the college. Yeah. So I remember getting into undergraduate teaching improvement in addition during my tenure there, which was fairly brief because Ed Young, the dean, eventually went on to become president of Maine and invited me to come there as in a role as an assistant vice president or something, and I decided that I didn't want to make that move. I mean, I would have been in three jobs in 3 years, which would make it clear I couldn't hold one. But so when he left, Leon Epstein came in as dean, and I worked with Leon for a while. But more and more, I kept getting involved at the chancellor's level in a variety of things. And I was then asked to review. I set up this system for extramural grant proposals, how they'd be prepared, who reviews them. And the chancellor had to sign off before it went to the business office. So I, in effect, part-time began reviewing all the extramural grants for the chancellor. Mm-hmm. There had been a person there doing that. And then after the chancellor, someone had to review them for the president. And that was across the hall in the vice president's office. And so I started doing it concurrently for the chancellor and the vice president. And eventually, I had to make a choice. And I was offered an opportunity to work with Vice President Clodius, who was Vice President. Now, this is the pre-merger university.
Right.
And so I went over there, I think first as an assistant to him and then as an assistant Vice President. And that in the pre-merger days, that was my title, and I was Clodius's number two. He had another person working with him on a few special projects, but that was one of the special assistants to the President, mm-hmm. Wally Lemon. And I think he had Roy Luberg in there, too, who was a dean of public services. And we also had Martha Peterson was here somewhere in the student affairs area, but had a relationship. And we were all kind of geographically located in the same area. Mm-hmm. So, but mainly I worked with Bob Clodius, and I began working on things like academic titles throughout the university. Divisional committee criteria for review for tenure. And I got involved by virtue of my interest in instruction and teaching from the earlier incarnation. I started to review all the criteria of the divisional committees. And what the emphasis then was that the criticism then was that we only hire research professors and they don't teach. And I was simply asked by Bob to look at those criteria and to meet with the divisional committees and to suggest that when a person came here for an interview, and as you know, people come in and they can be promoted to tenure, work their way, or if they're really good and they're over at Princeton, you can hire them into tenure. It was in this latter category that I was particularly interested. So the person comes in and gives a marvelous speech on his research interest or her research interest, but I wanted them exposed to, I wanted evidence of their teaching ability on the file, I wanted them to meet with students, I wanted those views, I wanted teaching faculty to meet with them. So I'll never forget it. I put together, and I think we touched on this earlier, but I put together a review of the criteria of those committee and made a number of suggestions in draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had to issue the formal suggestion because the draft led the divisional committees to change their criteria. And Clodius was very supportive. Harrington got a little bit of static for it. You know, who is this young whippersnapper there that was looking at divisional committees?
When was this one?
This was during my tenure as a I think the title was Assistant Vice President under Clodius,
okay.
Pre-merger.
Right.
Okay, and the divisional committees, as you know, were the bodies that the deans sought advice from when granting tenure.
Right.
Their advice was not binding, but you never took it lightly.
Right.
It was de facto binding, if not de jure binding. And so I worked on things like that, a whole variety of special things for Clodius, and attended the cabinet meetings with the president and got tasks and assignments out of that, and then, you know, things kind of blur in here, but eventually things began to happen, and we moved to Van Hise Hall, and the central administration moved out of the Madison campus, main bailiwick of Bascom. We had merged extension into, now that's being demerged.
Yeah.
I mean, I really have a sense of deja vu at this point. we combined cooperative extension and general extension, and we had a center system, and they decided they wanted a chancellor for each one of those. And maybe we needed a chancellor for the Madison campus, and the president then would become the central administration. And the term was coined, and Van Hise was built, and we'd ask for a separate building for the central administration. And Jairus Leonard, who was a state senator and chairman of the building commission, says, heck no, we'll just add 5 floors on top of Van Hise. And they did it right at the last minute, never added elevators enough, you know, it was really, but we did move to Van Hise, and took all the ribbing about being at the top of the ivory tower and in the clouds, because literally the day we moved, cloud cover came in, and at the 14th floor the clouds were there, and somebody got a picture of it. It was a marvelous thing. But it's then we formed truly a central administration distinct from the campus, which was kind of a harbinger of the merger with the central administration apart from the campuses. And it set up the dynamics between the president and the chancellor. Right. And Robin Fleming was a chancellor. Ed Young, you know, you remember going through all these things. And here was Harrington, the president, now sitting up in the Van Hise ivory tower. And with Clodius as the vice president of the university, and my title was, I was eventually made associate vice president, and then vice president for academic programs. So a portion of what Dr. Clodius was doing was broken off and given to me, academic programs and budget. So I worked at, we didn't have an academic affairs vice president. The vice president of the university was effectively that. Academic programs is where I set up procedures whereby new academic programs would be reviewed, evaluated, periodically looked at, worked with accreditation, institutional research. Budget was budget. I was, in effect, the budget officer on behalf of Clodius and developed all the university budgets. And that was my life, and that's what I did. And then merger came along. Harrington left. Yeah. Clodius was acting.
Were you involved closely with extension merger?
Not as closely. There was the Thede Committee. Wills Thede was the professor who was chairperson of the committee and did it. So I was there, but that was more or less handled by Harrington's person, Don McNeil, who became their first chancellor of the merged extension. So I was on the periphery of that, knew what was going on, knew about the dynamics between ag or cooperative extension and general extension. This is a big step because heretofore, all the appointments in extension, tenure, they didn't have an identity of their own. Suddenly we've created a new entity with its own departments, its own divisional committees. In other words, they used to have to go through the campus. Right. So if you were a political scientist in the center system, or it was called the extension centers before that, and you had to go through muster. And there was kind of a second-class citizenship. You know, you couldn't have the strong research criteria that you would normally have, so they gave a lot of awards of instructor with tenure. You know, normally tenure is associate in full. So there were instructors with tenure and assistant professors
in
tenure.
Extension.
In extension and the extension centers. When you made extension and the center system two chancellor-headed entities, and it gave them their own tenure-granting authority, and they set up their own tenure review committees, you had this whole residual of all these people. I began to get involved very much in tenure decisions, and this grew out of that earlier divisional committee thing, the criteria for tenure. David Fellman, former AAUP president of political science, was the resident expert on tenure. And I learned a lot from him, and when he left Chapter 10, which was the tenure rules and regulations, I became the touchstone for those interpretations. And to this day, I still get calls with departments who are sitting there wrestling with tenure questions, or can they have someone who's not going to get tenure come talk to me? You know, it's just amazing. It still happens to this day. And maybe when they all die off, this won't happen. So I was very much involved in that kind of thing. I was involved in things like undergraduate teaching improvement. I wanted a fund that would fund undergraduate teaching improvement throughout the pre-merger university. And we set it up and we gave awards and then we tried to replicate those things. It was really fun. And to take a portion, we would save money by cutting positions in the central administration. And it seemed to me politically wise to take $200,000 you saved and turn it into undergraduate teaching improvement grants. And the president and Clodius bought that and we did it. So there were things that I did. I was really involved a lot in the nitty-gritty of the university in ways that writing the basic guideline on extramural support, they still use it. With a minor, you know, with the changes of the time. I found, I was intrigued. I was an administrator out there dealing with this when I was at the research center. Seven different forms for making an appointment in this university and all sorts of things. You could check that form and give somebody tenure. I proposed a single form called a personnel action form, still used to this day. The academic titles, there were 470 titles used in the academic staff. So I wrote a guideline. I was great. I developed a concept. You're great in the quote sense. I developed a guideline system. Guidelines would not be offensive to faculty. You know, policies and directives are. It's guideline on academic titles. It's still used. Some form of it's there. So those are kind of things that made the everyday people like me, our lives easier.
Yeah.
And more people probably remember me for that than maybe anything else, kind of a plotter who worked on that kind of stuff.
Do you remember any of the other, there were some problems in merging extension with with people in Milwaukee and Platteville
Well, it wasn't Platteville. Remember, the merger of extension occurred before the merger of the two systems. So each of the state universities had its own extension arm, too, and the VTA system. So there were problems, but they were not problems. There were problems after merger with that, too, as well. But before merger, the main problems were extension had a good development in Milwaukee. In fact, it was the extension campus and the Downer and all that eventually became UWM and folded that in. There were problems of different tenure criteria, what to do about people who'd been around and overlooked. There were people problems. There were programmatic problems. There were, what were we going to charge? And should extension be self-supporting? And how much are you going to charge? And so I was involved in those things a lot. And I spent a lot of time dealing with extension and the center system. I really was interested in the center system. I thought that was a marvelous concept. And there's some of them are still called the extensions to this day. They don't like that. But I visited all the campuses of the center system. I was the only administrator that had ever done that. I mean, other than the formal. I went and spent days there. I went to classes there. I talked to all faculty and students. And at the end of my tour, I wrote a, I remember writing kind of a retrospective thing on it, which got printed in the center system faculty and student newsletter. More reaction to that. They were just delighted that someone cared. And I learned, I had a great respect for them. And I thought they were doing a marvelous job. I spent a long time defending their high costs if they were small. You know, well, then the state university system says what's good for the goose. So they began establishing centers that were extensions of individual campuses as opposed to a unique center system within the system. And I, you know, now that I mentioned that, I can think of hundreds of things. Their centers were better supported. The counties would give them more money, build nicer buildings. You know, oh, it was, and that was part of this tension that led to merger. Here were these centers springing up, and each campus had its own. Platteville had Richland Center, Medford and Stevens Point, you know. And some of them were built strictly out of the personality of the local legislator. Joe Sweda, the legislator that Medford, we called it Sweda U. I mean, it was there, and it was so small. I mean, they had enrollments like of 65. And these became symbols for people that thought there was wasteful duplication. So they were access points, though, and I could always make the case, and was often called upon to make the case that it, A, that those students did well when they came to the four-year campuses. And I remember doing a study where they did as well or better as anyone who started here at Madison, the center system transfers, that it was cost-effective for the student, it was the only way they could go to school. You know, so we were always defending, we were constantly called upon. There were classic defenses you had to have repeatedly. The important thing about the center system was when merger came, the question is where were those centers that were attached to the state universities going to go? And we put them in to the new center system. And that was a merger problem in itself. Green Bay and Parkside. Parkside had been split out of that center system. It was the Racine Center and the Green Bay Centers that became the basis for those campuses. That's what I've spent a lot of my time on, Green Bay and Parkside. You know, there were times it was taking half of my time. You're building campuses, dealing with two chancellors, trying to build them from scratch and try to give them distinction. We just didn't want them to be carbon copies of anything else. And I think we may have talked about that before, but lots of time. I think something that took me lots of time it was that. And I was the main contact for that, you know, out of Clodius's office. And this is all pre-merger.
There was visions of having those be very respectful universities, and it didn't quite turn out that way.
The visions, the real questions, were they going to offer doctoral degrees? You know, and the two chancellors wanted to know that right away. And were they going to offer master's degrees? And that was CCHE confrontation time, because here were the state universities all wanting to eventually offer doctoral degrees in education, master's degrees in everything they could, and replicating everything that was out there. So here came the two new kids in the block, Green Bay and Parkside. Green Bay, we tried to develop as an alternative, I often use the phrase, an alternative model for higher education, organized not on traditional letters and science lines, etc., but on environmental themes that ran horizontally across the ecosystems analysis, which no one knew what it meant at the time, you know, synthesis. And then we had to develop collaterals for the traditional business degrees and education degrees. So you would come in this way and then you get a vertical collateral that made you able to teach. Lots of problems getting all those things through CCHE, which was used to traditional things. Then down at Parkside, it said in an industrial community setting, there was an effort by certain CCHE members to make it a grand, an MIT, you know, kind of orientation. And it was headed by a historian from the Madison campus who wanted to make it a quality liberal arts enterprise. And there were lots of dynamics there. I just think of so many things that went on there. It's, you know, you can almost do funny tapes on Parkside alone or on Green Bay. And, you know, if you ever get back to doing the history of those, maybe we can talk sometime.
Okay.
You know, the Wiley, of course, has passed away. Widener is still up at Green Bay, but a lot of history. And they were both problematic to bring along, but the interesting thing is when things got tough on the campus with the quote, riots and the student uprisings, it was the political base of the Green Bay Parkside and Center system and extension that got us through the budgets. And I could call upon a network of 100 extension agents and say, we really need, you know, you're going to get lots of criticism. Here's what's going on. We just would try to keep them aware. And that was our local influence.
Well, you were working in that context. Was there the problem of lower enrollments than you had expected earlier? Was that
Green Bay and Parkside?
Yeah.
Yeah, the enrollments projections originally were pretty optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Green Bay was an enigma, you know, because it was a whole new thing. They were expecting to draw nationwide, and they did. They had a much more cosmopolitan campus, and with no dormitories at first, until we got David Cowley's corporation to build them. You know, Inland Steel finally built dorms up there, and they got them before Parkside. There was always this competition between the two chancellors, you know. There was a friendly competition, but it was clear.
Who were the two?
Irv Wiley was a former chairman of the history department of Madison. Ed Widener, who was a political science that came from Michigan State, I think. And both social scientists, it seems that all presidents about that time were social scientists. Harrington was, most of the Big Ten, most of the AAUP. And there was the competition was whose enrollments were higher and who was closer to their projection. What happened was Green Bay sort of got to a plateau and leveled off, and because we had building yet to do, you know, and the building programs, the building programs alone were just a big mess, just getting those through the legislature and getting them finally out of the ground. It was great to go dedicate the things finally when they finally came. There was so much.
What was the problem about building the campus on the wrong side of
Kenosha or on Green Bay? Green Bay, the first thought was, well, can we do something on Downer Avenue where the center was, just expand it? And then there was a site selection committee and various things offered, and they picked the golf course side, you know, thinking, and the chancellor, Widener, by that time was having, you know, he was the man. And he very much wanted it there. And there was a feeling, well, you build it on the other side, it would draw more people, it wouldn't seem so remote. Well, if you've been there now, everything's built up around it. You know, it's kind of like West High School, when it was built in Madison, was criticized for being too far out. The city would never go that far. Memorial High School, when they built it, they said the same thing. So, same phenomenon. The debate in the southeast was Kenosha Racine, and that's like the Hatfields and the McCoys. You know, it's kind of a traditional rivalry. They kind of build it on the border, but was still in Kenosha, you know. And on Petrifying Springs park property, you know, again a park setting, and there were so many debates around the sites and so much politics. It was incredible. But Harrington was masterful in this as well, and finally got it resolved and did it. It's nice to see it now. It's kind of hard to believe it.
I wanted to ask you a little more about extension.
Okay.
Do you have any recollection of, did you work with Don McNeil at all?
Not too often. Yeah. Really, that responsibility, he had been Fred Harrington's handpicked lieutenant, put in the job. That rankled a few feathers, you know. They wanted an ag person. And as you'll note, from then on, it tended to rotate. McNeil was followed by an egg, Henry Algren.
Yeah.
Algren was then followed by a non-egg, and now you've got a chancellor who came out of the egg side, Pat Boyle, I think came out of the egg side originally. So it was kind of this thing, kind of a gentleman's agreement, mm-hmm. That's how it would be. Don was a very enthusiastic, energetic guy with not always with a great amount of patience for the academic processes, and he did a good job, and he was present, and he was visible, and he was probably the right pick to carry out Fred's intentions for extension, you know, and did a good job of defending them.
Mm-hmm.
Big battles over what would it be called, UW extension or university extension. And there were people who would refuse to change their signs. Out in Lafayette County, the ag agent would still leave it, or he would leave up College of Agriculture Extension. McNeil would go out, tear the sign down, and come back irate. He wanted mm-hmm. The symbol, the logo, everything to go with it, to give it an identity. So Don was a necessary ingredient in their transition, and was Harrington's, had it the favor of the president. That means that the president defended his choices, and the president had a real interest in extension. He wrote on it eventually, mm-hmm. Was active in it many times. So.
Yeah, that was it. Kind of his baby, that merger.
Yeah, yeah. Will Steedy pulled it up. Yeah, it was. It was, and there's some people that predicted that would demerge within 20 years, which is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
The Aggies are going back to the Madison campus along with some of the General Extension folk, and after a while, it won't be there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I predict 20 years from now, they'll probably reinvent it. Things have a way of being cycled mm-hmm. like that.
There's no any other. Reasons you think why it's had to be spun off again?
Mm. It was the whole question of whether they could build their own identity and their own support and have a constituency out there that would support them apart from mm-hmm. a campus.
Mm.
And then with merger, it was the question was how would the dynamic of these nine state university campuses with their own extensions, that was one of the big challenges. How would we put that extension activity under the umbrella of University Extension, which was headed then by another person that Weaver had picked, Gene Evans, who was ag,
mm-hmm.
and we're back to the ag cycle. Yeah, and that was no mean task because these were money makers for those campuses. You know, Stevens Point and Menominee and the others, they were very aggressive, and there were all these little fiefdoms that had developed, each with mm-hmm. their own extension head. Pulling off that dimension, as I remember, I spent a lot of time on that, too, at the time. But the legislature mandated, was trying to knock off this competition,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so it finally worked out. It mm-hmm. took some real finesse, I mean real finesse, to pull that off. Yeah. Spent a lot of time on that.
Mm-hmm.
So the extension, as I think about it, I did spend time on extension, but not with the first merger, but more with the second merger.
Mm-hmm.
I got involved in their tenure and divisional committee and that sort of thing a lot. And, you know, got the academic side of extension. And their budgets, of course. I had to review their budget.
Did you were you active at all in dealing with student unrest in the late 60s?
Well, in the late 60s, prior to merger, no, I was usually not involved on the student affairs side of things,
mm-hmm.
and I was out of the college by that time, but I mean, I was involved in defending the university against people that wanted to throw everybody out, you know,
yeah.
and I had to spend a lot of time proving that undergraduate students were paying their way and that faculty were, in fact, teaching. I got involved in defending the university. I had students, you know, Paul Soglin and groups would come in and sit in my office and Bascom, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then when I was over in Van Nuys, as I said before, I had a lot of them. And, you know, those were tension times.
Yeah.
Do
you have any impressions of Harrington's behavior in that respect?
Well, first I saw Harrington, and then I saw Weaver having to deal with similar tensions later on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Dow chemical, Dow is just the code word you use to talk about all
yeah.
the Army recruiters, yeah. Military recruiters on the campus. I think that really got to Fred Harrington's gut after a while.
Mm-hmm.
To see bayonets outside the School of Education, you know, National Guard being called in. that had to eat away at you. And for a while, it was kind of amusing. Then you realized just how fragile the university is. I mean, anybody that wanted to rip it off, steal its computers, you know, it was such a relaxed and fragile. But the fragility I'm talking about is in its very texture, in the membranes. I mean, it was easy to make it look bad. It was easy to violate it. It was easy to stymie it. It was very vulnerable, fragile and vulnerable. And Fred, being a very strong president, you know, kept that from happening a lot. Harrington and Weaver after him tried to handle. Weaver was brought in because how well he handled student unrest in Missouri. You know, he gained somewhat of a reputation of being a hard nose, and when the board was looking for someone, it was a Republican and a conservative-dominated Board of Regents, and that did well in his behalf. But some of Harrington's lieutenants, like Bob Carbone, who was one of Harrington's, but I can remember a picture of him, an assistant to the president, pointing to the student disruptors and telling them to get the hell out, you know, and that made front pages, you know, just like the governor's wife telling the welfare people to get away from her gate, you know. Those are images that live with me, but I think it really eroded the spirit of someone who'd been in academia as long as that. I had not been here that long, but it sort of eroded my spirit too, you know, and it was difficult to...
Do you think that had a lot to do with why he left?
I think so. I think he sensed that things were coming, to other changes were coming. Mm-hmm. I think maybe he just had enough. You know, he was an academician, and I think he just had enough. Mm. There were other things he wanted to do. And no one was close to Fred, except Nancy, you know, and... there are people that could tell you they were and that they knew, but I don't think anyone really knew. He would have to tell you that.
Yeah. Well, I think we're just about up to where we started last time. I think I want to sort of skip over.
Okay.
The merger story itself.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
Go directly to its passage. That's where we left off, I think, last time.
Okay, I couldn't remember. Yeah, all right.
Talking about implementation. The one thing maybe I'd like to start with is the problem of system appointments.
Yes.
Right after.
Okay.
And
a lot of dynamics there. And you mentioned Weaver threatening to resign.
Yeah. Well, I was curious about that. There were articles in '71 about him resigning. I was wondering if that was a real threat.
As I mentioned earlier, John Weaver was a very personally sensitive individual.
Mm-hmm.
He did not have the thickest skin in the world. And he and Governor Lucy just never hit it off. And it hurt him a lot when he felt he was being personally impugned or personally assailed. And a person who has a thinner skin in that regard knee-jerks sometimes. And so John, you know, thought, well, good heavens, I was brought back to be president of the pre-merger university. He just sort of let the word out to some people, either a press person or something, mentioned resignation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in this town, words like that, then you get a lot of thumbsucker stories the next few weeks about who's going with it. Is Weaver going? Who's going with it? Will Percy remain? Will, you know, this and that remain? And me following, I never made any statements about it, didn't even think about it. I knew John didn't want to leave anyhow, so I just didn't comment on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I know one story said I would probably follow him out. I don't know what anybody considered that a plus or a minus. It was not a threat I made. Was it a real threat by John? I think not.
Mm.
I think not. I think he wanted to do it. He just wanted to establish the ground, and it was like anybody else. He needed to know he was loved by somebody.
Mm.
Yeah. At least respected. Yeah.
Well, then in the new system administration,
right,
it was given that Weaver would be the head.
He would be the head, and it was given that the number two had to be from the other system.
Mm-hmm.
And McPhee had just stepped down, and they brought Len Haas, who was a super guy, probably the best chancellor of that system, mm-hmm. from the Eau Claire campus in. I think Len was kind of bewildered by all of this, but he was a loyal person and felt to protect the interests of WSU. His colleagues wanted him, and his board wanted him. I didn't have any trouble with that. I knew that was coming. You ask a question in your notes about the first Joint Regents meeting. I made most of the arrangements for that meeting. I had to worry about where people were going. It was like 24 people. Eventually the board was 10 or 12. And getting those people and pulling that off. Roy Kopp was from the state university system, and Bernie Ziegler from the UW. I mean, I used to deal with State Department related things. I knew about the diplomacy and the seating protocol. So the meeting was in the Wisconsin Center. I remember it to this day. We had to make sure that meeting didn't try to do too much, you know. But yeah. We worked on it, and I worked on it with, can't remember who it was from the state universities, but the two of us sort of worked on the details of it.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any battle over the number two spot. It was just understood.
Yeah, this is from some newspaper report.
Yeah, no, it was just understood. It had to be, you know. There may have been people that would have preferred that I continue as number two, but I knew it couldn't. I just knew it couldn't be.
Yeah.
So the real question is, what would the number three spots look like?
Yeah.
In the first set, they were a matched pair. One was the vice president for the Chapter 36 institutions, which was me, the old UW, and vice president for the Chapter 37, the old WSU, which was Bob. Just did a blank. Still there? Oh my God. Anyhow. He was really their budget person, and finance person, and so that's how it was done. And Len Haas arrived on the scene, and I had inherited Clodius's office, you know, when I was picked, which is right next to John's. When Len came, they set Len up down at the other end of the hall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody asked me about this. They had just done it, and I could see. I mean, the symbolism was then that I was still number two, because I was in the. So I went to Len and I said, I think we got to switch offices. Well, I think he was terribly disarmed by that. And my staff was terribly, you know, saddened by it. I remember we moved at night one time. We just set him up and opened up a bottle of champagne, said, this is the way it's going to be. And then it was really something. And then the question of where were the two number threes going to sit. And so I said, we'll put Bob over right next door here. Same size office. Same. I think it went very smoothly. Mm-hmm. That was a short-lived arrangement, but it was fine. And it was important that symbolically, while this one and two was split, that number three, the people who had the budget control, well, and there was also Bob Polk, who was the academic person over in WSU. And so he was put in, but he sort of wanted to be vice president for academic affairs, but we didn't fill that position right away. So I was really the vice president for the old UW, and Bob Winter was the vice president for the old state universities. And Rube Lorenz was there doing the business, you know, Neil Cafferty. It was very interesting. Everybody finally ended up with a place, but we had a hell of a lot of people.
Yeah.
And there was expectation that we would pare back the number of people. And as things evolved, Bob Winter sort of moved towards the facility side of things. Neil Cafferty was gone, Ruben Lorenz towards the business, and I sort of moved towards the budget in the absence of an academic affairs. I was doing some of those things. Eventually Len said he didn't want to do this, he wanted to go back to his campus. But then it was natural to people that we'd move ahead, so I was named I moved in kind of into that role. But I felt we needed a senior vice president for academic affairs, so we had a shared position at number two rather than at number three. Bob Winter took facility. Pulling that off took a lot of finesse. There were so many personalities. Part of the office of the state universities were over in another building on Monroe Street.
Yeah.
It was who was going to be downtown. That symbolism, oh God.
That,
we still ran two
that.
Business offices because they were incompatible. They were just two entirely different, not the people, but the systems. Eventually we got that merged, and kind of the WSU people took over the personnel functions, and Ruben Lorenz took over the business functions, and Kent Hill was moved into one position. It was just a case of one for one, and then eventually we began to pare out people, and you had to cut the central administration. I remember we had to cut it by $300,000+, and that means you had all the Harrington people had moved over, Chuck Engman, a vice president. Excuse me. Oh, and that was all. That was not. there were not places for everybody.
Yeah.
And I was probably tagged as the bad guy. That was, you know, all these things began to happen. Mm-hmm. And finally, Bob Taylor ended up as vice president for public relations, but Bob Doyle from the State University then had to have a title. It was all this matching that went on.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't any real problem at the top. The real problem was below the top in terms of who gets what.
Yeah.
You also talked about the chancellors, bringing the chancellors as a body. And I proposed creating a council of chancellors. And we remember that first meeting. That was on the 15th floor of Van Nuys. And that took some real doing. And then Weaver had a big party and gave one of his traditional football speeches about, well, I'm the old quarterback, and you guys, we got to make this work together. And there was kind of a, let's all work together for the cause. Well, there was still this, remember, in the merger, the chancellors of the state university sort of bound together a lot more than the chancellors of the UW, because it was a system that was that way. And pulling that off and then establishing a faculty body, a faculty council, and what kind of representative body, a faculty senate, all those things I was involved in. Those were very good. And having Don Smith on board eventually helped a great deal with those things. But those, and so Smith and I would always have to meet. When we were both there, they always wanted to meet with both of us.
Mm-hmm.
It was good for us because we could keep track and we could cover for one another. But those were just pulling that off. Then doing the first budget together and having the first budget hearings. God, you can't imagine what the potential was for disaster there that you had to pull off. Or Don setting up a review of all the master's programs and proposing to eliminate, you know, X number, which is what the merger was supposed to do. And these were eliminated. Green Bay and Parkside had to lose as many in Prospect. You know, it was all this business. Mission statements had to be refined. These are all difficult, difficult things. There was and that we pulled it off was, to me, a minor miracle. And people felt pretty good about it. I've seen a thing out recently by the woman who came around 10 years later. I don't know if you've seen it. What were the attitudes during the merger? I don't know if you've seen it with paper. I'll try to find it for you. It's kind of interesting.
Mm.
How did they feel about the regents? How did everybody feel? And we haven't even talked about regents were almost a full-time occupation during all this. Because we had some very proactive regents that Lucy appointed, some very good regents and some not-so-good regents. And, so much of our life was taken up with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then political initiatives like, you touch on them later, like the scope effort and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you ask also the role of the ASUF, UWF, OSF they were called, Association of State, they became TALF. Marshall Wick and Ed, what's his name?
Music.
Music. They were ever present at CCHE and fairly ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
They are, hi, how are you? Who can I talk to? Where were we?
Ed Music and Marshall Wick.
They were kind of like the Gold Dust twins. They would come and put all, and it was always over salaries.
Mm-hmm.
Dollar equivalency they wanted, and then they wanted. It's the same thing you're hearing today.
Yeah.
It's just deja vu. But they, in the faculty bodies of the merge system, there was always the TALF organization in the background, which had its own agenda. And Smith and I worked very long and very hard at making each campus have its own identity, independent of TALF, breaking, you know, the TALF, it'd have to be a TALF position. The first few meetings, and Marshall Wick was on that group, and Music was on that group, and they were always wearing their TALF hat. And we spent probably most of our first year trying to at least get them to take off their TALF hat. Because you couldn't talk. You wanted to talk with them about faculty salaries, they'd put on their top hat right away. So you had, so and the whole push for unionism throughout this thing, unionization of faculty, which you see every year. That, if we had hours, I'm sure Don Smith talked about that, but spent a lot of time about the strategy. The chancellors did not want unionized faculty.
Mm-hmm.
None of us in administration did.
Nor did the Madison faculty.
Madison faculty didn't want it. And deep down in their hearts, neither did the Eau Claire faculty, although that's where Wick and Music came. They had the best faculty, incidentally, I think, overall. And that's a testimony to Len Haas again.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted them to develop, they said campus autonomy was so important throughout merger, you know, to protect that. Well, that means campus faculty governance. Well, there was no history of faculty governance in the state university. Gene McPhee ran that with an iron hand, and the chancellors worked for Gene McPhee. There was no question who they worked for. None. I mean, even Lee, you know, who eventually rose above that to become governor. But
so the TUF wasn't really a very powerful organization pre-merger?
No, not pre-merger. I mean, it was kind of a, you know, they would come and get outdrawn. But eventually they became powerful. In merger, there was a void, and they became mm-hmm. the spokespersons, and to their credit, they did a good job of it. Mm-hmm. And it's just that we were trying to develop a family, but there was always this entity over there. And that was occasionally you'd find that working against your interests. But so that's kind of what that story is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You ask about establishing a system database. That was a major tour de force. That was my responsibility. We had traditional institution research offices, and I had to restructure those into whole, and having a whole taxonomy now throughout the United States for colleges and universities. We redid the whole budget and all the institutional database. We created a student database, academic database, a facilities database. This was a major, major undertaking, and we pulled it off. And the Carnegie people that I mentioned before, Lee and Frank Bowen,
mm-hmm.
they were just amazed. And people came to see what they couldn't believe what we had done. You know, we had really turned out, and this is a testimony to the people that were there.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Well, I would just say parenthetically here, I'm not sure anyone interested in an oral history project, having listened to the great faculty members of our time, would be very excited about what it meant to establish a system-wide database or information system.
Well,
reporting.
You never know, really.
Let me tell you, I consider that a major accomplishment of the people that were there. We developed a system-wide budgeting process, a database and information system that I think was second to none in the United
States.
What
exactly is included in the database? What?
We had to build, we were called upon, one of the expectations of mergers, we finally get a handle on how many things there were, how often, how much, you know, all the indicators, what they call
mm-hmm.
performance indicators.
Mm-hmm.
And before they could never get apples and apples. You know, one person counted full-time student at 12 credit, another one at 15. So we had to get common, we had to establish a data element dictionary and common definitions, build a whole taxonomy to describe 27 campuses. You know, what a challenge. Jeez, you know,
did you have any input from other universities? Or
we looked at other places, but I hired some very bright people
mm-hmm.
and just let them go.
And who are
and
they?
Elwin Kamak was the person we brought in from Utah to head up the office, OASIS, Office of Analysis Services and Information
mm-hmm.
Systems. I didn't want it to be institutional research. I wanted, which used to write things for other institutional researchers to read. I wanted it to be a real management support unit. And then Elwin put in very bright young people, really good people. And we built the database, and that was a major, you know, I had to, because your future was tied up in that.
Mm-hmm.
How we classified courses, students, the differences between the divisional splits, humanities, social science, arts, physical sciences, and then we categorized the cells we would use to describe how many level one students, how many level two, what were the costs of those students, what were the costs for teaching English at La Crosse versus teaching Eau Claire, and explain those differences to me, Mr. Vice President.
Mm-hmm.
I was always getting hung up on that. Why does it cost you? Why are the classes smaller in the freshman years at La Crosse than they are in Menominee? There was a reason, you know. But I had to find the differences and then defend them. But more importantly, give the people in state government who paid the bills, you know, and were the DOAs of this world and the legislature, a sense that we were on top of it. I had a budget office that was the best in the country. The fellow who was the principal, the real numbers guy who put the stuff together, his name was Ed Horkin. He was so good that all they wanted to know in the legislature among the staff were the Ed Horkin's figures, and if they weren't, no one questioned. And so the history of CCHE had been a history of statistics and data that could always be attacked and always was wrong,
mm-hmm.
or was always found to be wrong in some way. And this is because you could always kill somebody with statistics.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had to build an integrity to our system. We had to build an integrity to sell inside, too. You had to believe you were being fairly treated in your budget request and in the accounting and everything. And Ruben Lorenz was a master on the business side, quickly acknowledged to be very good. Winter facilities was a natural for him, and general administration, and Bob Winter over there did very well. But Reuben was premier in the United States as a college and a university business person. And, you know, what you have to say in here somewhere is all that you're talking to me. But me, I was just one of many people that was there. And the Elwin Kamaks, the Gene Irons, who I brought in to be the budget officer, you know, after I was up as senior vice president.
Say that.
His name is Gene Arn, A-R-N-N. He had been in the state and worked in DOA. Then he went down and he was working for a management consulting firm in Chicago. And I was trying to find the best person that had ever been through state government in budget. I said, it's Gene Arn. And so I talked him into coming. Elwin, Kamak, there were a whole series of people we were able to hire who were in key positions who really attracted excellent people. People who were other university systems tried to steal. That was your real test. You know, when they came raiding, they always seemed to come to Wisconsin because you could get a person who was well trained and who had real skills. And so personnel policies are so much different. The two tenure systems, oh my God. We had campuses that where the bulk of the departments were 100% tenured by virtue of the way tenure was handled in the state university system. Oh, it's just an unbelievable problem to handle. I spent a lot of time working on that. So did Don Smith. But like I say, our roles were kind of blurred. Don could do anything I could do. I could do some of the things he could do. He was the one who was the multi-talented one and could go both ways. I could partially go both ways.
Was it the same team that formulated the composite support
index? Composite support index was kind of a, that invention sort of came from my side of the thing. It was a way, the nine state universities wanted to know they were being treated budgetarily in enrollment funding and support the same as Green Bay and Parkside. The Silver Spoon was in Green Bay and Parkside. Just like the state university centers got a better deal, they felt the Parkside and Green Bay campuses. So much of the first 3 years was explaining that we were with an even hand treating Parkside and Green Bay, yet those were new campuses and you had to have money up front.
That was WIC and
they were always attacking it, and so were the chancellors. And Ed and Irv, the two chancellors of those campuses, were always viewed with a little bit suspicion. The composite support index was a way to rationalize everything that was happening, and it led people to believe that it was done fairly. They really helped me invent it, you know, and Don and I both worked on it.
Could you describe it briefly?
All it was a way to take campuses that were different in terms of their academic program mix and show how money went to support those in a way that seemed to be equitable between them, that you could really compare apples and apples, you know, and that was really tough with Green Bay because they were shaped like pomegranates, you know, or pears or plums. They weren't apples in the usual sense. So, and every time you tried to do something that made them look like apples, they thought they were losing their identity. The composite support index, the whole question was enrollment funding. The big CCHE question was enrollment funding. This was the time of great enrollment growth, and that was the engine that drove everything.
Yeah.
It was eventually the engine that was they took the wheels off, put the brakes on, and froze. But during those first 3 or 4 years, the CSI, even the WICs of this world, the faculty dissidents, bought it. And they bought it as a fair way to allow Madison its distinction, Milwaukee its distinction as a doctoral cluster, because we had doctoral cluster index and non-doctoral index. And that was very important. You could compare them across. At the undergraduate level, they could be compared straight across. And it proved that those two campuses were supported below what many of the state university campuses were, you know, in terms of money going for undergraduate education. And it allowed us to make the distinction, which for a long time was accepted for faculty salaries, for a whole variety of things. It was, to me, the key. It was the key. A data system that people felt had integrity, a budget process that they thought was fair, and a way of allocating the new monies that they thought was equitable. And it was copied elsewhere. They gave it other names. It was probably our greatest exported product. And for technique, all techniques last for a while. This worked for about 5 years. Then you invent a new one, you know, which is usually the old one renamed, redesigned.
Well, I wanted to ask you about some things that Donald Smith talked about. And that was the budgets that you operated in,
mm-hmm.
the first couple yeah. of merged budgets, and the suspension of enrollment
funding.
And what Mr. Smith seems to, or stated that those were, you know, periods of crisis management.
They were.
And
yeah. Crisis, internally generated crises between campuses, you know, because who was going to get, now it was a question of distributing the decrements,
mm-hmm.
not the increments. Lucy's productivity cuts, budget cuts, this whole thing, and then external crisis. Everybody became an expert on the university. Everybody ran, you ran for public office in this state by running against the university. That's, and there, we lost any constituency for the university among legislators. There was no one who was a champion of the university. It was an embarrassment for some people in Madison to have to defend the university, but they knew to get elected, they probably had to.
Is that a function of the
times?
The 60s?
Yes, yeah, the residual of that whole thing. But and Madison was synonymous with the university before, and then this distinction, and but how, passing out the decrements, my God, how do you do that in a way?
Mm-hmm.
Because to be an effective academic administrator, you would want to reserve your strength. And the strength was not unique to the Madison campus, but you had to protect that. You had to protect the strength of Eau Claire, but you had to get them to agree what the strength was. And the whole mentality of the Marsha Wicks and the others of this world, everybody gets the same.
Yeah.
We make our excellence out of getting the same. Well, you don't do that. You've got to have peaks of excellence, and that's why we did the core missions and the special missions of those campuses. And so we began funneling limited dollars to only those things that were mission-supported. They could not try to be all things to all people. That was viewed as decremental budgeting. But getting a handle on the budget was one of the great expectations of merger among the legislature and among private, you know, business folks and others who were supportive of it. So designing a budget system. And the real test of it came when we had to do the tough things, when we had to pass on the cuts. That's the real, it's easy to pass out. That's upside mm-hmm. administration. That takes mm-hmm. a different kind of administrator or skills. So we designed a system that worked both ways, which was the nice thing about the composite support index. You know, because the composite support index was the way we gauged mm-hmm. before and after, and how you were doing and whether it was fair. And the decision item narratives was a thing we invented. How could you, in a massive system like this, have discrete budget items? You know, it used to be the budget came up, I want three secretaries for the Department of Wildlife Ecology. Well, we forced them to put them in decision item narratives, which are more composite, larger. We want to improve undergraduate education in the sciences at River Falls.
Mm-hmm.
That will take four professors. A decision item narrative then held together, and it was the way they wrote it. You know, and it was a format, but it was a good, because you could rank those things. You could set priorities. And they quickly found out, that's what I, you know, you have seven decision item narratives. I said, fine, now tell me what the priority, well, they're all first priorities, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would have the budget hearings, and then I would look across and see which DINs or decision item narratives, what were the common themes, affirmative action, disadvantaged students. And I could then sell, if you can imagine, kind of an omnibus DIN, an omnibus decision item narrative, and it would carry along, and it was, you know, they had to assail the concept. It was no longer saying, well, in Green Bay, they don't need a secretary, or put two phones in one office, you know, these. It got it on a programmatic basis, mm-hmm. and you had to make decisions, but then you could set priorities. And when we went to the board, we had Group A and Group B, mm-hmm. you know, and it was great. People came, they started copying that around the country. It was a good way in a large system. And the beauty of it from a campus point of view was I let their narratives go through exactly as they wrote them. And I had to teach a lot of people how to write them. They were their own worst enemies. And then the central administration recommendation was on the bottom. The integrity of what they wrote, how they wrote it. And when we turned them down or we put them in Group B, I would give all the regents and all the DOA and all the legislative staff the decision item narratives we turned down. And our reasons for turning them down. That had never been done before. You only saw the residual each time.
Mm.
That gave people confidence out there in Eau Claire and La Crosse and Superior. You know, that their DINs, it was on, you know, look in Book B, that's where they are.
Mm-hmm.
So we also went through zero-based budgeting was big at that time, which means you review everything. And it was impossible on that scale. But we went through one of those, too. And we pulled it off. But I finally said the best way to do zero-based budgeting is one biennium do libraries, the next biennium do computers. Not every year justify every program. It's paper intensive. But we did it as a way of doing it ourselves rather than having it done to us. And it gave a certain integrity outside to our process. But there were people that respected that budget process inside and out. In fact, downtown, I think we were viewed as a tough customer because we came under the budget that was tight, that we could defend, that was well. They couldn't shoot us down for all the reasons they used to. Sloppy. We used to, I mean, we could get things through on the sheer weight of Fred Harrington or Gene McPhee's personality. Mm-hmm. But now you had to thought, it was a new era. PPBS, the Performance Planning and Budgeting System, came big in the state or federal government. All these, you know, things were going on.
Was there, did those budgets improve productivity, or was there damage done?
Well, the productivity part of the budget, that's kind of an aside. Productivity was a dirty word in service industry. It was never used nationally. They didn't even have a productivity factor nationally. But when the Lucy got on it, he found out the national productivity among non-service industries was 2.5 or 4, and so he said, that's what we're going to do. That was a bunch of crap. Mm-hmm. That was just budget cutting by another name. It was across-the-board budget cutting. I was always an opponent, and am to this day, of across-the-board budget cuts. You could say, well, that's the easiest politically. Everybody suffers. That's true, but you can just, some things you can't, you know, and that's making decisions to be unequal in your treatment, and then living through those and surviving was the real test of academic leadership, you know, in those days. We did well. I think the budget system that we developed, all these, this infrastructure of systems, which is a massive undertaking. You could have paid Booz Allen or a big consultant $7 million mm-hmm. to do what we did. And we did it with people on the inside. And I was really proud of them. It was fun. And I'm still proud of that, and I'm proud of what's still there. I go back to this day, and now I'm back as a faculty member. And I'm dealing with systems that I had a hand in along with other people. And that's kind of fun to know that they had some, that they were found to be useful. Or full of use over time. You want me to move on to the discussions of any of these other things here?
Yeah,
how do you
sure.
want to flow? In terms of
well,
time, we're going to run out here for me shortly.
Okay, well, what I'd like to talk about is, it's in connection with a couple of other interviews, is the management of computer facilities.
Okay. Pre-merger, post-merger?
Well,
you need
right.
a little bit of both to
right.
understand it.
Yeah.
Okay. Prior to merger, there was a hearing before Governor Knowles. And during that budget hearing, when we didn't have it in the budget, it was announced that we had just signed an agreement for a multi-million dollar computer. Knowles was furious. This isn't in your budget, you're just going to go ahead and do it? It was in the budget, it hadn't been approved, but we had signed, Time Magazine broke that we'd signed a letter of intent.
This was
now. Oh, I shouldn't use that phrase, but literally the shit hit the fan. I think that was the one reporter's description of it. In those days, you put S blank blank T,
right.
hit the fan. It really did. Knowles, who is a very calm person, just became irate, and Paul Hassett was his executive assistant, and this led to a major inquiry. And what was going on in computers? Well, in the pre-merger UW system, there was this great dream of a computing utility. Merv Muller, other people were brought in, mm-hmm. very bright guys. There were lots of other people involved, but there's this dream of a computer utility that would serve the whole state. And mm-hmm. what happened was, just prior to merger and with merger, they started looking at things horizontally, and when they looked at computers across all these campuses and added up the bill, before, when you just looked at the campuses, you never caught, but when you saw computers, you know, $20 million for computers, then that's something you have to control. So the computer utility was going to be a pre-merger and then a post-merger solution. It never happened. Computer manufacturers always oversold what their products would do. You could never get vested interest. And this is before the big micro movement or the standalone movement. That's mm-hmm. all changed. Everything has changed
yeah.
now. But management of computing facilities was really a big problem, and I was involved in that a lot in the pre-merger business, as I recall.
There were some There's some memos from Harrington's files
mm-hmm.
about the budgets of the MAC.
Created the MACC.
UWCC, about mm-hmm. how they really didn't operate on a budget, and that was
yeah
was a big problem. Was there a problem with sort of computer mavericks who wanted to?
Yeah. Everybody, you know, it's a question, we want to have our own in the SSRI, mm-hmm. and it's a question, it's like libraries, which I later studied. My mm-hmm. most recent effort on the campus in management was the library study, which is a whole different thing. But the computers, well, that eventually ended up somehow on my doorstep, as I recall. Finally, was there. And the whole question was, do you give money to the users of computer to purchase the service from the central facility, or do you give it to the central facility to divvy up?
Mm-hmm.
The latter was the way it began. And Merv Muller got very nervous because there was never enough money to go around, and so there was this concept of putting the money out, or at least have memorandum accounts whereby you would be charged even though you didn't have the money, as if you did have the money. And making it other than a free good, the library was a free good.
Yeah.
Computers had been a free good for so long, and so we had to put some kind of discipline into it, because you could pour more money down a computer rat hole than you. It was a great sucking noise for money, you know. And nobody could make real good decisions about computers. They were oversold by the salesperson, but everybody wanted one. And the trick in that business at that time was being bright enough and wise enough to make the right choices and not overcommit. Mm-hmm. The utility concept bombed. It didn't work, so the campuses went their own way. And then after merger, it was the question of what kind of computer capability. And then decentralization became more and more the mode. So But there were times when it was just very difficult to deal with the computing problems on the campus. And most of the computers were supported in Madison by research money.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much money for instructional computing. And I spent a lot of time trying. I said, students are going to have to be trained on computers. Let's get money into instructional computing, not just in computer science department. Mm-hmm. Statistics and computer sciences broke off from statistics and numerical analysis and became computer science. You know, numerical analysis became computer science in my time.
Mm-hmm.
We brought in people and the research orientation, but I always felt there was this instructional orientation of it. So I can remember getting involved with those things. Don't remember all the details.
Mm-hmm. Were you on the computer guidance committee?
Was that the name of the? Was that what I called the group after merger?
Yes.
Okay.
And
let's talk about spending
on.
Yeah. What we had to do after merger is everybody wanted to spend money on computers.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some real zealots. There was a guy down in La Crosse who had built his whole network out with the school system, and he had the answers. And then the person at Green Bay had the answers, and everybody in Madison always had the answers. Mm-hmm. And they always wanted money. And we needed some way to control the growth of computers, just like the growth of academic programs. But more importantly, we needed a way to get expertise on computers out to those campuses so the chancellors could make judgments and not be sold by a snake oil salesman
yeah.
who came in and said, hey, here it is, the biggest.
Mm-hmm.
And the compatibility of computers for business purposes, UNIVAC's here, Honeywell's here, mm-hmm. IBM's here, and how to avoid a monopoly by IBM or whoever. So one of the things that occurred to me was we need to do rational planning for computing in the system, just like we needed to. This came after budgets and after data. And the Computer Guidance Committee was kind of the interesting way we did it. We had somebody from all the different types of campuses on it. And we had a staff to it. And we formed subsets that would go out to campuses and kind of do on-site reviews. And they would be invited there. It was important to me that they be invited there by the campus, and that the reports be given only to the chancellor, not to me, and that the chancellor, he or she, would make decisions mm-hmm. then. In other words, I did not use it. I used it as a kind of a cooperative of expertise. And it worked like a charm. I think that people got respect for one another. The guy from La Crosse really was pretty bright. And these guys from Madison really weren't all wrong. And they always didn't vote their interests.
Yeah.
And it was a way to rationalize computing services, because we could have spent a lot of the money that came in from enrollment or for anything else could go down that drain, that great sucking noise.
Mm-hmm.
So how to have an adequate computing system? What kind of computing systems did you need for a research campus versus for an undergraduate campus,
mm-hmm.
or primarily undergraduate, non-doctoral? what do the center systems need in the way of computers? You know, and God, had there been micros and minis computers at that time, it'd been super at these prices. But I mean, computers, they just cost this world, and you were overtaken by the state of the art would change within three years. And software, we never really understood that was really the thing that really counted, because you got yourself locked into software systems that locked you into hardware systems.
Who did you, must have depended on someone to...
Yep. If you look back in those, I'm going to forget some of the names now, but Larry, oh boy, I feel so badly because I should recall all these people. There was, on the Madison campus, there were two highly respected people who were on the Computer Guidance Committee, a fellow from La Crosse, one from Eau Claire. And then I had a real good staff of people working with them. And,
was Ted Wheezy?
Wheezy was administrative data processing, and he came out of the old UW system. And he had a scheme kind of for a utility on that side. And his reach exceeded his grasp at some time, and he decided this was not for him, and he left.
Yeah.
And there was a young man under him named Dewey, Jack Dewey, that then sort of rose and was... And you had this administrative data processing. Remember, that's different from instructional computing. Yeah. Administrative data processing, you had strong people from both the previous systems there. Wheezy, then Dewey, Jim Baxter, Fran George from the WSU side. And gradually we began to use both groups. And Baxter was kind of the staff person to the Computer Guidance Committee, and with Fran George helping out of the WSU. And I don't think Madison campus ever asked us for advice, but everybody else did. And Larry Travis, and who was it? Dick from business school? Oh, I feel so bad because I worked with him. Well, anyhow, there were people who were very effective and took on kind of a system citizenship and worked hard to develop system citizenship. You'd never get loyalty to the system. How the heck do you love a system? Hard enough to love a campus, you know, let alone your own department. But I think we made some real strides there, and those were quiet victories. And finally, the external monitoring of us, they had kind of a czar in the state government who was approving everything, and they would always pick a person who was, at best, competent mediocrity. People, but they had very powerful positions. They were wanting to approve each new key punch. I remember fighting with I did not want the state to approve each new key punch machine, so we fought constantly against state meddling and oversight through DOA, and there were some real battles there. Finally, they got enough confidence that we knew what the hell we were doing, they would delegate more and more out to us to make the decisions. As long as you didn't abuse that privilege, you know, you could do it. It was very important, I think, you'd have to interview other people, that we were viewed as credible and trustworthy. Prior to merger, they always thought everybody was out for their own. And they had to gain some confidence, and that took a lot of doing. You had to be honest and open and as good as you could. I think Don Smith was very good at that, too.
You just mentioned that it's hard to love a system. That touched off something for me. I was talking to Odie Fish last week, and he expressed the fear that what may happen and what may be happening now to the system and to the Board of Regents is similar to what happened to CCHE.
Absolutely. If you want to talk about the present moment, my perspective on the future, we now have a void. O'Neill has announced he's leaving. The Madison campus, and to a lesser degree the Milwaukee campus, are locked up in an internecine kind of thing with the rest of the system over faculty salaries. The first ever real recognition of faculty salary needs. This would be the ultimate irony if we lose this because we can't get the family to work together. This would never have happened before, I can tell you, because we had built a family, we had built respect, and we found a way between composite support index and distributing merit money and across the board versus merit was a big issue. That wouldn't have happened in those times. I couldn't say it wouldn't happen now. It's going to happen. Here you have a void. O'Neill's leaving. I believe what is going to happen is as follows. If there remains a single Board of Regents, I think we're going to have demerger de facto. I think Madison and Milwaukee will end up under a separate entity, whether it's a sub-board of a board whatever. And the board will become the CCHE, mm-hmm. and we'll be back to the pre-merger days. And there'll be two subgroups, two boards, or two sub-boards of regents. They may call them boards of visitors to take a name they already have. They'll do something, because Madison and Milwaukee...
You think the outstate folks will let that happen?
Sure, yeah. Because they think they'll do better not in the same system with.
Yeah.
See, they now have the name and the reputation of UW. They'll never change that. It'll never go back to WSU Eau Claire.
Yeah.
Never. They've got out of it about what they can get, maybe, is what they might feel. But my prediction is the successor to O'Neill will be presiding over a much different... Mm. And whether he or she will be permitted to preside is going to be a real question. Mm. There's going to be something happen to allow a separate status for these. And look what's happened. Extension is being merged back into Madison. Center system may be problematic in this. But you watch, it may get put in the VTAE system.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that happening. Community colleges, which never win in this state, that could happen too. I think you're going to see... You're not going to see a minor fine-tuning here. Yeah. You're going to see a basic change and a regressive step, in a sense. If you think evolutionarily, it's not circles we're going around in spirals, and this time it's going to be a little bit higher but different.
Do you think there's a problem with that job, the system presidency?
Yes.
And Weaver, in his interview,
said
that he probably wouldn't have taken it.
No constituency, no history, no tradition for it or the board. So they had to build it from the ground up. It was the closest thing to an impossible job in terms of living up to the expectations that came, the baggage that came in with it.
Mm.
But I think it'll even be more difficult. No. I can't imagine the people who are aspiring to it now. Because it looks to me like a no-win situation. And that being the case, the person that's going to be drawn to it will either have to do it totally out of loyalty or out of willingness. They want to do that as kind of their last thing that they haven't done. That's why David Carley, for example, is interested in it.
Mm.
Something that's always eluded him, just like the governorship. And this is more prestigious, quite frankly, than the governorship. And I think he might be capable of doing what needs to be done, but I just think things are going to change, you know.
Well, just to close up, I want you to talk a little bit about your own career in education. I want to know if it's over. Will you ever go back to?
Well, my current academic administration is over. Yeah, I think I can say that with some degree of certainty. I'd worked in research administration, then academic administration, human services administration. Those have been my three careers, and now in a subset of human services, namely health. I'm going to do this for a couple more years, and the reason I'm here at this clinic is to learn about ambulatory health care, which I'm supposed to be teaching about health care management, among other things, at the university, and I continue to teach there. I'm a faculty member, a clinical faculty member in preventive medicine, and teach in business students, medical school students, and engineering students, plus a few political scientists. I'm going to do this, and then I want to go back and teach, if not there, somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to teach. I taught in the School of Education. I had a PhD seminar on higher education, academic administration and budgeting kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I love teaching, of all the things I've done. I taught in the Graduate School of Business, a course on planning and budgeting. I'm now teaching in the graduate programs in health services administration, administrative medicine, which is physicians wanting to become administrators, and some in the public policy track, health, public policy and health. I enjoy that. I am co-chairman of the curriculum committee there. I have graduate students. I just finished a master's thesis with one who's going to reorganize the Mexican health system, public health system, and he's liable to do it. He's a physician. I want to go back and I want to teach. It's not that I'm a philosopher king, it's just that I think that I've learned enough to learn how much there is I don't know, because I just want to learn more. I just love to learn every day. Every day I find out how much there is I don't know. I love to read, I like to write, I've developed a facility for writing. I have a love affair with libraries, which got acted out in my library management study for the Chancellor of the Madison campus.
I have a love for scholarship too. You kind of had a unique career in that you never had an advanced degree.
That's right.
Was there pros and cons to that?
Sure. It's been kind of funny. Throughout my career, it was said, I'll retrace it just kind of with the headlines and the stories and the social talk very quickly. Try to cap it off to let you know I haven't lost my sense of humor. I had an undergraduate degree in political science and history. I did some graduate work, but never finished it. There's too many more important things to do. I just could not see doing that. A great respect for people that could pursue, as you're doing, all the way through your doctoral degree. And I was told, well, you wouldn't get a top job in research administration unless you had a degree, doctoral degree in science. And I got a top job. And I was told I could never break into academic administration, certainly not as an assistant dean or anything. Mm-hmm. Well, somehow I managed to do that. And then I said, well, that's fine, you won't go any further. And somehow I became an assistant to the chancellor. And, well, that's probably good, but you can never do academic affairs. And I became assistant vice president, associate vice president, and vice president for academic programs, budgeting. And I said, well, you'll never be in the number two job in the university. And I said, that's probably true. And suddenly, I was executive vice president and had academic affairs. And throughout all of this, it was always suggested that without the advanced degree, I would be not acceptable for various things. Mm-hmm. And for some people, in their mind, that those two things could never go together. But I think anyone who came to know me knew I had a great respect for people with advanced degrees, and that occasionally there are people who can do things without them. We had some fine full professors on the Madison campus who had no advanced degrees, mm-hmm. Fine labor economists, a whole variety of people. And so when people ask me, you never became a university president. Well, I was a finalist for three outside this state. Could have had two of the three chancellorships or presidents. Been the first ever non-PhD to have those, but they're a family decision. So I'm always fond of saying, well, the reason I haven't gone on has always been a matter of degree. and it is. I would love to, I've written 10 dissertations in my lifetime. I've defended more theses and dissertations than any doctoral student ever will. The only difference is everybody else gave me the grades in this case. It was whether we were supporting a university budget or defending tenure. I appeared many times to defend tenure. And I thought I did a pretty good job of it. And I had credibility because I didn't have it, nor did I have the degree. And then finally said, well, you could never be a professor on the campus. I'm proud of the fact that I can be a professor, that my student evaluations are among the highest, anywhere I've taught, that I have a different approach to teaching, that I love it, and I enjoy helping people reach their potential. So, you sit there and say, wouldn't it have been nice to have been president of this or that university? Sure. But I wouldn't want to do it now. It would have been nice at that time. And when Weaver had the heart attack, Don Smith kind of pushed that role back and forth. I knew I could do it. Mm. I can do it today. I'm not even bothered by, you could say, well, that's supreme confidence. But I know what I can do. So I know I can do it. So no question in my mind I could have done something like that. And I think I would have been pretty fair at it. I would not have been the worst president anybody ever had. But except with my wife, I seldom talked to anybody about those days or those times. And now, the presidency's open again. This is the third time. Always the first stories that come out say, here are the candidates, Dave Carley, Don Percy. Of course, Percy does not have the degree. The article will always say, Percy does not have an advanced degree. Yeah. The article will always say that. And it's always written by people to whom that degree would have meant nothing anyhow. But it always seems to be in the minds of certain, quote, Madison faculty, that was my one character defect, And that did, in the early times, the first time I was on the list, I never sought the presidency. And I always seemed to last right up to the last minute, I guess, from what the people told me after the fact. But it was often a case, and particularly the campus I was supposedly partial to, although tried very hard not to be, was always the campus that would undermine any, allegedly, all I knew. I never really cared at that stage. Sure, you're disappointed when you think you could have done something, but it was kind of nice to go out, be a finalist, and I'm talking major universities. I was a finalist in three, and could have been a finalist in a total of five, mm-hmm. and could have had two or three of the jobs. Glad I didn't take them when I watched what happened afterwards. So once I knew I could do it, I stopped worrying about the fact. I don't worry too much about what I might have been. I just work pretty hard at making the most of what I am. You know, that's just kind of my philosophy. That's how I got where I am, and enjoy everything I've done. Mm-hmm. Going to go to my grave thinking, wondering what I'm going to be when I grow up. That's kind of it in a nutshell.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.